So our next item is going to be enforcement, item 19. And before I request Mr. Harris to introduce the item, I'd like to mention as your chair that when we had our last meeting, I was a little frustrated with the process of the ACL that took place, and I was not pleased with the what I perceived as a waste of my time preparing for this, and I also had received concerns from some of my fellow board members. So I requested a debrief on the last ACL, and we had this conference call, which was very productive. And so we've also, with a suggestion of Mr. Harris, said let's have a little discussion on this, on the process, and let's see if there are any ways maybe we can adjust the process. And as I remember mentioning to Mr. Kerrigan, I said the intent is not to change the law. You know, Jessica would never let me do that. But maybe there's a way to change the process on how we apply the law, making things a little easier for all of us. So this is the purpose for this agenda item. So Mr. Harris, I'll let you give the introduction.
So we're pleased to have Chris Kerrigan, who's the Chief of the Office of Enforcement. I'm not sure that's your correct title, but Chief Counsel, Office of Enforcement. And he's here today to discuss the enforcement policy and particularly the settlement negotiation process. And I understand from Chris that he's preparing to propose some changes to the enforcement policy, and I think he'll probably discuss that today also. Chris.
So yeah, good morning, Chair Wolf and board members. I am Chris Kerrigan. I'm the director of the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. They do call me chief. It's a little bit of an unusual term, but I've learned to accept it. I'm gonna talk a little bit about the Office of Enforcement, some of the things that we're doing, and then just dig right into the topic that Chair Wolf indicated that he wanted me to discuss with you today. The Office of Enforcement consists of four units and one new unit. We have a legal unit with 11 attorneys, and they support your staff on all the enforcement actions that you see and that you don't see. Many informal actions don't arise to the level where the board gets involved. The investigation orders are issued, notices of violation are issued. And our legal division provides support for your office and your staff consistent with our separation of functions doctrine. We also have a fraud, waste, and abuse prevention unit that investigates fraud against the UST fund. We've recently put a consultant in jail and fined him $2.5 million. We have several other cases pending. Apparently, and I won't give away any state secrets here, there's a lot of fraud perpetrated against the UST fund, and we are dedicated to ferreting that out and deterring it. We also have the UST enforcement unit that investigates underground storage tank violations, a special investigations unit that provides technical support on highly complicated matters.
There was one word that we didn't hear. The last fraud, where?
The consultant's name is Kurt Hayden. And Hayden Environmental Enterprises, and he did a lot of work on the Central Coast and was a consultant in Santa Barbara County, had the several facilities there, and was convicted of a felony fraud, actually pled guilty to felony fraud. So bilking the fund for unworked hours was essentially the main allegation, although he had several schemes in place. And then we have our Special Investigations Unit, that provides technical support. You may have seen some of the members of that unit testify in the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitary District Administrative Civil Liability Action. And then now I have a new pilot program, which is the Cannabis Enforcement Unit, which is to deal with many of the environmental impacts, including water supply impacts to surface waters mainly, from cannabis cultivation in the state. And so that's a new unit, and it may or may not go away. It depends on how successful we are with regulating that activity. So John, you want to put me forward one slide here? In addition to So we have different types of priorities for this year, some new priorities. As you may have heard yesterday, I know you did hear, the drinking water program is coming over to the State Water Board. They have a lot of really cool enforcement tools under the Health and Safety Code that we'll now be assisting them with using. And so we are now, this is our newest client, the drinking water program. We're looking forward to servicing them. I also have the cannabis cultivation unit that I mentioned. And then about 2 years ago, we took over water rights enforcement, and that has been a really interesting challenge, as water rights is a very unusual area of the law, and it's a very challenging area. And then, of course, right as we're getting our feet wet, everything dries up. And so we're doing a lot of curtailment enforcement and drought enforcement, too. And then I'll also address, and this is the main topic today, the ACL process and settlements, and we'll talk about the hearing procedures a bit and potentially engage in some dialogue about how that might be enhanced. But our ACL process generally, the staff investigates cases come in through complaints, we do our own investigations, we prioritize those based on threat to water quality or the board's preferences or priorities. In this case, maybe groundwater is a really critical issue. We apply the penalty methodology, as you did in the South San Luis case and other cases, and then we engage with the discharger to try to see if we've done that correctly and appropriately. John. So under the drinking water program, some things that are emerging now, the groundwater strategic plan is something that the state board adopted, and there are many implementation tools in it. There is a component for enforcement that we are engaging in. Then also the ELAP is a lab certification program that where labs are certified, and these labs do all of our environmental compliance data. And we've uncovered a lot of improprieties amongst the labs, so we're not getting valid data, and that means our enforcement actions cannot be pursued because our evidence is tainted. We've had a very difficult time working with Department of Public Health to engage in enforcement actions with respect to labs where we have uncovered improper actions. Now it's in our shop. We have two cases ready to go. We'll be rolling them out right away. And one of them involves a pretty horrendous level of fraud where the lab is actually reporting under methods where they don't even own the equipment to comply with the method. And then we'll also be engaging in a sort of ferreting out data from local agencies to whom the Department of Public Health has delegated its authority, the county level. There's not a real smooth transition of county data to the state system under those delegated programs. So we want to make sure we're getting the data because, of course, in enforcement actions, as in any regulatory action, data is really critical, but I think in enforcement actions, we really need to have robust and high quality data, especially to assist your staffs with prioritizing where to take enforcement. The cannabis cultivation unit is really an important thing that we're working on now. We engage in targeted enforcement. Our approach is to take enforcement on private land against those who hold themselves out as medical marijuana growers. We want to push them into a regulatory program where they comply with BMPs, just like any other farmer or construction workers or construction project would do. We don't get into trespass grows. We're not law enforcement. But the environmental degradation from growth on private land is really, really acute in the North State. So we have a pilot program where we're going in there. Surprisingly, we've begun to engage in education and outreach already, and it looks like we'll probably be able to enroll up to 50,000 permittees in the first few years of the program. There's a real rush to establish legitimacy amongst this group of persons because they feel that this is going to be legalized beyond medicinal use in the coming years, and they don't want to be caught in a moratorium. And then we have a lot of interagency coordination there. We work a lot with Fish and Wildlife. We do support on degraded lands to help determine what's necessary to restore those lands. And then with water rights, we're supporting the division on curtailment notices and with respect to enforcing the emergency regulations that have been adopted now. So we've got a lot of new work in the Office of Enforcement in addition to our support that we provide and have been providing to the regular program staff and all the regular programs. So for today, I wanted to talk about prioritizing enforcement. And again, here, the staff and our staff, your staffs and our staffs join together and do investigations. projects and enforcement matters kind of come up through an inverse funnel. We have attorney liaisons assigned to your region, and the attorney liaisons are available on call to negotiate or discuss enforcement issues such as access, need for a warrant, level of sampling sophistication, proper enforcement tool on a moment's notice. But we also have a monthly prioritization meeting where we all work together to determine what is the appropriate level of response or the appropriate enforcement tool for this type of case. So there's a whole prioritization process. And I want to give kudos to Mr. Packard, who was one of the leaders in developing an enforcement prioritization process that we seeded around the regions. It's now used universally in every region, where we have regular meetings and we prioritize and think about where to put our resources when it comes to enforcement so that we get the best deterrence and the best effect towards compliance. Once we've had those prioritization meetings, it's often determined that we need to engage in further investigation. Maybe we'll issue an investigation order to get more information about the nature of the discharge. And then as we go through prioritization, we have these different matrices that we would look at to determine what's the most important type of case. What's the magnitude of violation? What's the threat of beneficial uses? Did it affect a sensitive water body? Are there other people that are doing the same thing? What's the scope of the problem? Are there facts that mitigate the violations? Did the discharger respond quickly and try to mitigate the impact? So you may have seen the big news about the spill at UCLA, and it was up to 50 million gallons of water were spilled. Did they react soon enough? Could they have stopped that at 10 million or 5 million gallons? Those are the kinds of things that we look at with your staff when we decide whether a case should be prioritized for enforcement. The Office of Enforcement assists at different levels, and I talked a little bit about the attorney liaison that's assigned to each board. I think your board has two liaisons now, so we have a backup, both a senior attorney and a junior attorney who can be contacted at any time. Oftentimes people are in the field and they're, is this a situation where I can enter the field? Do I have probable cause? Is it an open field? Different legal questions that would potentially taint evidence if they did enter without consent or a warrant. Those kinds of things, we want to make sure your staff has access to people in those situations. And then the liaisons participate in the monthly enforcement meeting, assisting with prioritizing cases, as I described. And then we act as an advisor to the assistant executive officer, who in your region is the chief prosecutor. And the assistant executive officer here is very collaborative in approach of working with staff to make all the strategic decisions in the case in terms of where it sits in priority, what's the appropriate tool. And we may want to start with a notice of violation. It may be that we're just going to do a cleanup and abatement order. Or we may establish a cease and desist order with a time schedule that, if not met, will result in violations. So the assistant executive officer makes the discretionary call on those things, subject to our advice and counsel and the input from his staff. To assess the administrative liability, what's the process we go through? So the enforcement policy recognizes sort of that there's a uniqueness in each region. Just as the previous speaker was saying, septic systems aren't the same in every region, and enforcement and violations don't have the same sort of impacts or priority in each region, and a case may look a little bit different, but it's also important to have a consistent approach throughout the region so that a sewer spill to the ocean that closes a beach has a similar consequence in San Diego and as it might here in Santa Barbara. So it's important to have a certain level of consistency, and I call it rough consistency, because that provides fairness to the regulated public and also a reasonable expectation about how to modify or adjust their business practices for compliance, or what they can expect. And it's also important for us that we do that in a transparent fashion, that we show our work, that when we make findings about the impact of beneficial uses, that those findings are supported by evidence. What was the beach closure caused by? Was there contamination that killed fish? Where's the evidence to support a harm to beneficial use or what the level of harm assessed might be? So by showing your work and making sub-findings that then support the ultimate conclusion, the public can look at what you're doing and the regulated public can look at what you're doing, both citizens and the dischargers, and see, this is what I can expect if I have a problem of this nature. And so they can adjust their business practices accordingly, and then the public can also be assured that the board is acting in a fair and transparent manner that protects the public interest. So when we do an enforcement action and we do an administrative civil liability case and we look at complaints, the assistant executive officer and the staff apply the methodology in the same way that you do. We go through and we marshal our evidence and we go through the methodology and we come up with a recommended civil liability. Then after we've gotten our first preliminary assessment based on our best available evidence, we engage with the discharger because we want to make sure that we're seeing things that everybody else is seeing and that we're assessing the evidence in a fair light. So when we engage with the discharger, we may think, well, we didn't know they hired 3 extra vac trucks to get out on that spill immediately after the spill took place. And even though that it was a pretty substantial spill, they mitigated that pretty well. So we engage with the discharger to sort of determine and maybe reassess and reevaluate what our preliminary use of the methodology was. And then what we do is we determine a range of possibilities. A lot of times you sit down with a discharger and you may have a disagreement over whether the harm to the environment was moderate or acute, or maybe between that somewhere. And so reasonable minds can differ on the assessment of evidence and where it comes in on the penalty matrix and the methodology. It's not an exact science. It's not a mathematical formula, even though it's algebraic in the way that it's applied. So when we look at it as the staff, and when Michael looks at it as the assistant executive officer, there's a range of possibilities that we believe would be appropriate to settle on that would be consistent with the factors that are in the methodology, not outside the scope of the methodology. If we can't reach an agreement with the discharger that we think is within the reasonable range of possibilities under the methodology, then we feel it's appropriate to come to the board. If we're going to act on the outskirts of the regulation, because the enforcement policy does have the force and effect of a regulation, it was approved by the Office of Administrative Law as such, we want that decision to be made by the board. That's your call. If we're going to really get out to the outskirts, then we go to the board. And I'll just give you this example in the South San Luis Obispo matter. The penalty handed down by the board, while it was not quite as much as the prosecution staff was asking for, we would have settled for that, and we would have actually settled for less than that, a little bit less. So there's a reasonable range of possibilities, and in fact, there's only one case that's come up in the last 5 years that we've adjudicated in front of the boards where we did not get the penalty that we would have settled for. So generally speaking, we're very close with the boards, but what we do is when we go to the hearing, you're not going to see our lowball offer as our suggested penalty. What you're going to see is somewhere from the middle to the upper range, because otherwise a discharger would have no incentive to ever settle with us. And so that is our practice, and that's how we look at things. We're generally looking at kind of the middle range. The discharger's looking at the lower range. We'll go a little bit lower, but if we get too low where we think it's not evidence-supported, evidence-supported findings could not be made consistent with the methodology, then you're going to see that matter and you're going to get a chance to adjudicate it. Let's see. We continue with our engagement, though, after the complaint is issued. So we issue the complaint. That doesn't mean that settlement discussions are off. And in fact, psychologically, the dynamic is that the closer you get to the hearing date, the more incentive the parties have to settle, because the engagement is really a zero-sum game when it comes to you. Someone's gonna be the winner and someone's gonna be the loser. And so parties generally tend to wanna bound their risk. And so as we engage with the discharger and they see our briefing and the evidence organized and marshaled in a more formal way, and then they see their attorney's fees going up, and the potential for risk being there, that the board may issue a higher penalty than the staff would be willing to settle for, The time is ticking, and we often settle cases during the process. Many of the more difficult cases are settled towards the end of the process, or even, as you saw in the Pasatiempo case recently, right before the board hearing. And I think that's pretty typical of what you would see in litigation. You've probably all heard it frequently stated that the case settled on the courthouse steps. And in fact, juries are impaneled and dismissed because cases are settled even when after the jury's been impaneled. So we issue hearing procedures that establish a set of deadlines by which the parties engage. It establishes briefing and evidence schedules and just has that hearing date looming out there in the future, at that point in the future where D-Day is going to come and the parties are going to have to come and roll the dice in front of the board. So then what happens in a settlement negotiation, if it goes the other way, if it goes well, which 90% of our settlement negotiations do go well, it's negotiated by the enforcement staff, and Michael Thomas, your leader, the assistant executive officer, consistent with the penalty methodology. And you heard me describe the range that we're willing to engage with. And then we present it to you as a stipulated order, a settlement agreement and stipulated order. Our practice now at the Office of Enforcement and at the Water Boards for the last 5 years has been to enter all ACL actions as stipulated orders because they're really easy to enforce. Otherwise, a settlement agreement is simply a contract that needs to be enforced in court. So we get them all entered as stipulated orders. It memorializes the obligations of the discharger to pay the penalty. And more importantly, their obligation to do compliance projects or SEP actions, or many of the agreements also have injunctive components that require the discharger to do certain things to reestablish compliance. And of course, that's job one for us. We really want to make sure that our enforcement actions are resulting in sort of a measured and very quick response to come into compliance. So again, it can provide for actions by dischargers to attain compliance in addition to the payment of the penalties. And again, those are enforceable because they're entered as orders of the board. Sometimes, the discharger is always waiving its right to a hearing within 90 days, which is a statutory requirement. Sometimes, or usually, there's no admission of liability on the discharger's part. It just sets forth a series of obligations that are enforceable. But we do use the previous settlement agreements and stipulated orders as evidence of prior enforcement actions. So if you're seeing a discharger who may have settled matters two or three times before, we're going to put that out there. We're going to say there were violations were alleged, they were denied, but there was a stipulation in order, so that you can see that this isn't the party's first time before the board. The stipulation is between the discharger and the prosecution team, and then it becomes an order of the board upon execution by the regional board. And many boards also have a delegation to their executive officer, which I think you may be considering here next up, to settle within certain parameters. And so then that would also establish an order of the board if it's so delegated. So some of the boards allow, in fact, the Region 4 board and several other boards now allow the executive officer to hold MMP hearings and issue orders on MMPs, so mandatory minimum penalties. There are also several alternatives, and we discussed some of those, so briefly I'll cover those. We'd like to fund supplemental environmental projects, and again, Region 3 has been one of the leaders here, the Central Coast region, in establishing programmatic or board prioritized SEP projects that we can steer dischargers into funding. Many of the regions now are looking to do that. Compliance projects are where a small disadvantaged community can take the penalty money and apply it directly towards fixing their system in a way that achieves compliance that's related to the violations. And then enhanced compliance action is a tool that we're trying to work with more and more now. It's something that the discharger doesn't have to do legally to come into compliance, but it's a really good idea that they probably wouldn't otherwise fund. And so by way of example, in Santa Margarita Water District, which is in Region 9, the northern region of San Diego County, or of the San Diego District, there was a force main that ruptured, and it could have been replaced, but it went right through Santa Margarita Creek, and it had a big dip as it went through the creek. Well, they didn't have to move the pipe. They could just replace it with better equipment. But it's just one of those situations where, because of the terrain and the stress on the system, it was just not a good place for that pipe to be. And we couldn't compel them to move the pipe out of the creek, but what we did was we allowed up to 50% of the project money, or the fine money, to be used to take the pipe out of the creek, route it down the street, hook it to the bridge, and take it over so that the chance of a spill, if it happens, getting into the creek is greatly diminished in the future. So it's an example of a thing they aren't legally required to do to come into compliance, but it's a really good change in engineering, and we can allow this to happen. And so we've done some things with ECAs now that are really valuable because they're not limited to small disadvantaged communities. So where you have site constraints that you can work with, it's a really good tool. So the methodology is designed to achieve fairness and consistency through transparency. It's also really important when we deal with this, and this is a statutory requirement, that we need to at least recapture the economic benefit gained from the violation and to set an even floor so that those who are cheating on their environmental compliance are not just getting fined the cost of cheating, but they actually pay more than those who would comply voluntarily. Violations and penalties should have a reasonable relationship to the gravity of the violation, the harm to beneficial uses, and also the harm to the integrity of the regulatory program. If people are just refusing to acknowledge that they're in a regulatory program or should be, that can be very difficult as well and warrant a reasonable fine. John? So the board has opportunity to provide input on our settlements. All the settlements are noticed for a public comment period before they come before the board or to the executive officer. If there's an issue, the board can take it off the consent calendar or have a public hearing on it. Sometimes there's delegation to the EO. Sometimes it can go on the consent calendar. But in any event, if there's significant public comment or if there's a complex SEP or ECA action, those kind of things come to the board for their input. So then there's a public hearing, and the board has the opportunity to weigh in. So even on settlement agreements, the board always has the opportunity to weigh in on those. So given that background, I think that in light of the chair's and our discussion about the recent Paso Tiempo, I'd like to entertain suggestions for improving our process and seeing if there's a way that we can do better for the board and make our process quicker, easier, more transparent, and yet still maintain the core values that we want to pursue. So.
Thank you very much. That was a nice summarized overview. There's a couple of options there I was personally not aware of, as you know, aside of the SEPs, which are the enhancement projects. A couple of approach perhaps we could consider. One of them is a settlement conference that we could require engagement of the parties, because they have to then bring all their evidence and sit everybody at the table. So that would be one option. That perhaps you could elaborate a little bit on the mechanism of it. And the other one is that, you know, you mentioned usually issues get settled on the steps of a courthouse, and I recall when I expressed my frustration to Jessica about the last minute settlement, she said, well, we're used to that as attorneys. I said, you used to be abused. I said, you know, it doesn't necessarily really, I didn't feel it is a fair process for staff, because it's very time consuming, and for the board, you know, where we review pages and pages of information, try to do a good job doing our homework. We do our homework and there is no final test. So it's like, gee, I wasted my time. So perhaps another approach is to set up a deadline that would be before the formal hearing with the board. And I know we talked about it a little bit, and you know, there's still the issue that the parties could say, well, I'm not settling, and I'll take my chance and go in front of a board. And then at the last minute, you know, they would say, well, okay, let's settle now. But if there was some mechanism of pushing and saying, you know, if it's going to be a week or 2 weeks before the scheduled hearing with the board, it is to your advantage to settle now, because if you don't, you know, you may really take chances here of actually ending up with, you know, penalties that you may not like to see. So if you could comment on these two options.
Well, the first option is something that's fairly common in a judicial proceeding. And so just to set some context, these would be potentially additions to your hearing procedures. And so the hearing procedures now have sort of a rhythm to them where there's a schedule, an exchange of briefs, and then they lead up to the hearing. So it's possible that we could build in either of these two options or both into your formal hearing procedures. And so the first, to have a mandatory settlement agreement for the parties, is something that's very common in judicial proceedings. But I will say that the staff is very open to always meeting and pushing and being available to the discharger, irrespective of the nature of a mandatory settlement meeting. But it could certainly be something that's on the calendar, and so that the parties are looking forward to it and they can come and engage maybe one last time formally. And then maybe attached to that would be a subsequent drop-dead settlement deadline. As Chair Wolf discussed, I'm not sure if the parties actually reach agreement after that, we would want to go through the formal exercise of having a hearing. But having a deadline on the hearing schedule is certainly an option. So I guess I would like to hear the board's thoughts on that approach to amending the hearing procedures.
Thank you very much. And we really are encouraged to think about how we can make our process efficient, but also recognizing that preparation for ACL for board members who have other obligations, you know, during the workday, those are quite a burden. And so there did, you know, the Paso Tiempo did become that kind of moment when we went, wait, is there a different way? What I just heard you say, though, and this is what I just clarify, that if we imposed a drop-dead deadline, but then they settled anyway, a drop-dead deadline to me would be, that's a blackout zone. You have until 10 days before the hearing. At the 10th day, there is no more dialogue, because if the staff continue to then say, well, we'll engage, then that's not a drop-dead deadline to my thinking. So I think what we've been talking about is that we have this, we impose a period of time during which there are no further discussions, because you are now into the hearing lineup, if you will. Everyone else has to kind of deal with that 10-day notice business, and if they don't come forward in time, they cannot participate, or, you know, they lose options as you get to that 10-day point. So what we're trying to figure out is, can we actually make it a blackout, like no more talking?
You absolutely could do that. I would because that would be within your discretion. But my sense is, then I've just posed this question for the board's consideration, is would then, if the party decides to settle for the amount in the complaint after the drop-dead deadline, would the board still then insist on having a hearing and preparing, or would you rather have 9 days notice that the party's going to settle for the amount in the complaint? So I understand the idea in the abstract. I just want the board to understand there's some difficulty with implementing it in practice. So, but again, it is within your discretion to amend the hearing procedures in that way.
Mr. Chairman, can I add to that? Another aspect to that, Chris, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chairman, I think the reason for having a deadline and a blackout date is the concept is based on saving time. The board wouldn't have to review these documents unnecessarily, which makes sense that you would want that. the one thing to consider is that with a drop-dead date, what may very likely happen is that cases do not settle, and you start hearing these enforcement cases that you otherwise would not hear. How much time is involved in hearing enforcement cases? If you start getting the majority of these cases coming to you, you could may very well spend the majority of your board meeting time doing enforcement. These, as you know from the ones you've done, these can be all-consuming. And they can often result in more than one hearing, multiple hearings for a single case.
Which is fine with me. I love being in front of the board.
So it's something to consider. It's something to consider within the context of saving time.
Well, I know my fellow board members have questions and comments, but I mean, right now, it's not working very well. So, and there's probably not going to be the silver bullet here of a perfect situation, and we definitely need to look at unintended consequences. So, you know, I totally agree with that. So, with that in mind, Mr. Johnston had raised a question, and then Mr. Young.
Yeah, I'm not so thrilled with the idea of a drop-dead date on settlement because, I mean, part of what sparked this discussion was in the recent ACL, we learned, I think, on the first day of a two-day meeting that the second day was canceled. And some of us, Mr. Jordan, for example, had taken a vacation day to be there. It wasn't really skid arranged for somebody to cover him. It couldn't really be rolled back. But I agree with the concern. You know, even in that situation, I would rather, if the settlement is there, not do the hearing, than go ahead and do the hearing and come to the same result. I do think that there are some structural things that we can do to push for earlier settlement. As you referred to, Chief, there is a tendency to settle late as the attorney's fees build up, as people look at the witness list, as they have to do all that work. And I think both on our end and on the discharger's end, there's a tendency to push the work, since everybody's loaded up, there's a tendency to push the work to the deadline. So I kind of like the idea of a mandatory settlement conference in advance, and I like the idea of the briefing deadlines and the witness list deadlines being in advance of that settlement conference. So that, because I think it's kind of pointless to do a settlement conference before you've done that. You're just building some legal fees for whoever's defending the discharger. I think it's a lot more productive to do that settlement conference. And I mean, I'm just trying to think it through. And it seems like if the briefing deadline and the witness list deadline, seems like it needs to be enough in advance of the settlement conference that people have had an opportunity to digest that and to really understand where they're at. In other words, if those deadlines are the day before the settlement conference, then it doesn't necessarily serve our purpose. But if they're far enough in advance that counsel has a chance to review them, the counsel has a chance to review that with their clients before the settlement conference, so that people are really going in informed, then maybe that does help our process.
A suggestion consistent with your idea that's a natural fit would be to have it right before the rebuttal deadlines, because at that point the party is prepared to submit their rebuttal or needs to be pretty close to prepared, meaning they've reviewed the materials, and so it's either okay, we're going to settle, or we're going to continue to incur fees and go down the path of submitting our rebuttal. So just as a suggestion, consistent with your thoughts, that would be a good time for it on the hearing procedures.
And does being after the rebuttal deadline better inform a discharger's decision on whether to settle, or is it, or is being before and having the looming fees of preparing the rebuttal? What do you think better motivates a discharger here?
It's a good question. I mean, most of the dischargers we deal with, we settle before the matter's briefed, and before the, really a lot of matters we settle before the complaint's even issued. So we get into these clash situations. I think the prima facie case is understood. Counsel might have a suggestion on that too. So I think it goes either way. Personally, coming from private practice as a litigator, I know clients were glad to and relieved to avoid continuing to pay my fees to in an adversarial way, and they were happy to just pay me to resolve it, you know, draft the settlement agreement. So I think my perspective may be a bit skewed, but I think it would be just before the rebuttal.
Okay.
Yes, Jessica.
The other thing to think about with the timing is if the discharger has not waived their 90 days to a hearing, is all of these deadlines are very quick. And the farther out you put the settlement conference, the closer it will be to the hearing. If you're waiting until after the rebuttal, you may be actually very close to the hearing date, and which may or may not achieve those your goals.
How common is waiver of the 90 days?
In a complex case that goes before the board, it's very common. Almost universal.
Mr. Young?
My suggestion for this process parallels with what Mr. Johnston had said, and I think that what Dr. Hunter is concerned about, and certainly the rest of us are, is when we have set a date aside to do a hearing, and we go through the laborious process of reviewing everything, that it then becomes, you know, waste of time. So we want to create a process that further motivates and encourages settlement and kind of shifts the risk of not settling even more so against one or both parties. I think that having a mandatory settlement conference at some point in advance, that makes total sense. Mandatory that the parties are present with their attorneys. All documentation needs to be submitted at some point in advance. Of course, not only the witness list, but the list of exhibits and the exhibits themselves. And any motions, if you want to call them that, to anything that's going to take place, that those need to be submitted. And then the consequence would be, if those deadlines are missed, and this would be by an order signed by the chair of the board, that if they don't get their witness list in, their documents, exhibits in, that they will be precluded from offering written evidence or adding to their witness list after that point in time.
In the hearing procedures that exist, those deadlines are set, and they do require exhibits, briefing if there's legal mm-hmm. argument, all the evidence, including the witness identification and a summary, you know, a brief summary of the testimony to be offered by that witness. Those are provided by the prosecution team in its case in chief, and then by the opposition in their opposition. So that would all be on the table under the current hearing procedure. So again, if you slide that settlement conference in subject to that, it would have that exact dynamic that you're seeking.
I'll also add that we already, if either party side misses the deadline, we have said that they cannot add to it later. In the Pasatiempo matter, for example, the discharger kind of did not want to take the time to submit evidence. So we told them that they couldn't have any witnesses because they didn't submit a witness list.
The boards vary on that. Usually the ability to augment the witness list or the evidence list after the fact is liberally granted to the dischargers, not so much so to the prosecution team. But those are that usually has to be done by motion to the board chair to get relief from the hearing procedures.
Well, it should be for good cause.
Right, for good cause.
Good cause. Yeah. Let the board chair decide whether it can be let in.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think that would motivate people, I mean, to get ready with their case and be serious about talking about settlement and having the MSC completed. And then the board can know we're going to have a hearing. And so you got to start reading your materials. And I think that would help. Now, I don't think we should have a blackout phase because, you know, they may want to settle at the last minute for whatever reason, okay? And I think we want to allow them to do that. So.
And the comparative advantage here might be achieved. It might become so much more rare that we do have a settlement after the MSC that right. that we've really gained a lot by just adding in the settlement conference component.
So, Mr. Jordan?
So, listening to all that, how do you have anything that's mandatory without having a blackout date? How do you force me to come to a mandatory settlement meeting if there's not going to be a blackout date following that?
Well, the courts do it. I mean, it'll work. I mean, we engage with the other party, and so if the party doesn't show up and we report to the chair and the board understands that that happened, I think that has its own consequences flow from that when the hearing happens. So we have mandatory hearing dates. We have deadlines and things in the procedures. If you blow one, you have to get relief from the chair. It's not necessarily that easy to get it. I think there may be rare cases where the parties refuse to engage in settlement in the settlement conference, but I would guarantee you that those are going to come before the board in a contested adjudicatory proceeding. Or that would be my strong suspicion. I guess it's as a lawyer, I should be no better than to make guarantees.
Okay. I think everybody else, I might have been the most vocal one in the particular case with the inn because it definitely affected me personally the most in that particular case. So thank you, everybody, for carrying some water for me there. But one of my recollections, too, if you're just looking for carrots, so to speak, too, was the discussion back to the sewage waste plant,
South Sound, Spispo.
And my recollection down there on the bottom of the worksheet in terms of actual direct or indirect costs related to staff and or board. And it's a long time ago, can't remember. I had a working relationship with council that was tough at that time. Just because it was an ACL and I asked questions. But my perception coming away from that was a really undervalued category with also an inability to actually recapture what had to be real costs, that it was capped, that it was up until the hearing date, it didn't include the hearing, and that particular hearing was excruciating long with a whole bunch of people in the room, plus ourselves. And so just a suggestion I would have that as a further carrot to settling is that if you actually get to a hearing date, that there's a real cost. There's a cost to the building. There's a cost to people being there all day. There's an extra day of lodging for a bunch of people. And it just seemed to me to have some more latitude there in poking the guy and saying, you know, if you get the hearing, it's not just what we worked through the worksheet here, there's actually another significant cost coming to you to what the costs of that day or day and a half are going to be.
So it's a really good idea, but it's important to understand that we need to balance the party's right to have a hearing with what we can incentivize. So if we chill the opportunity to have the board hear a matter in such a way that there is not a legitimate access or too much of a threat of no access to the board, it can be difficult. Now, we are entitled to recover staff costs, but to get the board's hotel fees would maybe be over that line. So it's important to make sure that we are not infringing on people's rights to have a neutral arbiter adjudicate their question by making it too expensive to access you, versus recapturing our legitimate investigation and staff costs. And I think doing a better job there and making it clear that, hey, you know, when we go to the hearing, we're gonna ask for more staff costs because our costs went up. That's a way that we can address that.
Okay.
But I just want to caution you, there are limits there, I think, that we need to be aware of, but we can do some of that.
There were limits in that process. Yeah. I don't remember if it was dollar caps or whatever, but when that was questioned, that was the number. And
right.
It just seemed like such an absurdly low number for the effort that had been put into the process so far that, you know.
And I'll speak to this too, that I am in the process of amending the enforcement policy to make our language about recapturing staff costs for recalcitrant dischargers stronger so that the boards are able to do a better job of doing that.
Okay, and then I had questions on a ECA too. Do you want to finish the enforcement or do you want me to just go ahead?
I wanted to come back to finish that item.
Okay.
Yeah, and
thanks.
In case I overlook, remind me. And before I pass the mic to Mayor Delgado, you know, I have to mention too that it's not just the last ACL that prompted me to exercise concerns, but you know, as being new chair, I tend to look at things, you know, with a different pair of eyes, and I kind of look at all our different procedures and how we do some things and look for little tweaks, you know, that we can have left and right. So it's not exclusively that ACL that polarized, you know, me, but although it definitely helped me saying, we got to do something about it.
It's a good thing. We always need to look for ways
but,
to
you know, I think that's part of our job, mm-hmm. is always try to raise the bar, all of us. So having said that, Mayor Delgado?
I just had two questions that were not related to the topic we've been. They're enforcement questions brought up by here. So are we done with the...
No, I'd like to come up before we
close
this item. I'd like to come up with some consensus that we give direction, and perhaps then you can craft language for this, and this would become part of our Central Coast region policies on the ACLs. And it appears right now that it appears right now that, you know, there is one item for which, you know, I feel a consensus, and that's to have a settlement conference with the caveats that were added by Mr. Young, who certainly has some background in previous ACLs and also the input you provided. So having said that, Jessica,
my recommendation would that.
That
I
was
think
not
the
for you, by
may
the way.
The
festival is on.
My recommendation would be that the board provide direction to the advisory team to modify the hearing procedures to add a mandatory settlement conference. And when that occurs, you can either leave it up to the advisory team or say at the time of rebuttal or, you know, within a week thereafter.
Can you repeat that? I just lost it. My train of thought.
That my recommendation is that the board direct the advisory, the EO, and myself to modify the hearing procedures for all future enforcement actions to include a mandatory settlement conference, and that would occur either you can leave it at our discretion to place that in the hearing procedures or at a date that you dictate, meaning I'd recommend at the time of rebuttal or a week after.
So my question is, are we talking about modifying our procedures or are we talking about modifying the enforcement policy to incorporate some of these?
No, the hearing procedures in each region are unique.
Correct.
And so, although fairly consistent. So I think that the fix here would be to modify the hearing procedures that are pertinent to the Central mm-hmm. Coast.
Exactly. Yeah. That is what I would like to see. Yes, Mr. Johnston.
So what council is suggesting is a settlement conference at or shortly after the rebuttal due date. And what I was hearing from Mr. Carrigan, correct me if I'm wrong, is that it might be more effective to do that before the rebuttal date and sufficiently in advance of the rebuttal date that attorney staff time on both sides won't have been spent preparing the rebuttal to give an incentive. Is that correct, Mr. Carrigan?
That would be my recommendation to both parties, because they would have the ability, you know, not just the art time, side saving time and money, but the other side. And so sufficiently after the submittal deadlines for the cases in chief, but potentially a few days before the rebuttal deadline.
And do we want to specify how far in advance of the hearing date that some minimum period in advance of the hearing date that settlement conference would be?
Well, if you say 5 days or before the rebuttal, then it would I'd build that into whatever the hearing procedure dates.
So the rebuttal dates are already built in a specified number before the hearing date.
Thank you.
It's all rhythm.
So what would you recommend in terms of the gap between the settlement conference and the rebuttal dates?
Well, I would recommend a short time because it's really tight there.
And, it's tight.
So,
I understand.
But I would say 3 working days is probably a good suggestion. So.
Okay. So 3 working days. And then, you know, you write the language, and from what I sense from my board colleagues is blackout is out, I mean, in the true sense. and then one of the things we discussed, you know, is to try this. I mean, there's no perfect system. And if we see it flops, well, then fine, we try it. So this is not the end of the world. You know, we'll kick the tires, see how it works, and so I think that would be already an improvement.
With a deadline for the submission of exhibit lists and witness lists concurrent with the briefs.
Right, that's in advance of the settlement.
Yeah, conference. I just
absolutely that already occurs.
Yeah,
okay, wanted to make sure it's part of our direction.
All right, so then the next item, and Mr. Delgado is next, and then Mr. Jordan had also. These are separate items. Okay, so Mayor.
Right. Very brief. When you were discussing cannabis and drinking water issues and water rights as new priorities, what old priorities, existing priorities, will get less emphasis as you focus on those three new priorities?
None. This is the state government. We continue to focus on all of our previous priorities. But I will say this. We've resolved a big part of the MMP backlog initiative, which took a fair amount of time. So every year or two, we want to move into an area where we're using a certain percent of our resources in enforcement to focus on a specific problem. So some of that will be shifted. We may not have an initiative for a couple of years looking at a specific or targeted problem. The initiative may be the drinking water program analysis. So we had the MMP initiative, then we had the sanitary sewer overflow initiative, where we wanted to take some action, be it an investigation order or a penalty action, for any SSOs over 50,000 gallons. And so we were looking around, and we at the Office of Enforcement, we determined that there were a lot of 50,000 gallon spills where there was no action being taken. And of course, in the grand scheme of things, we have several million gallon spills per year, but those are significant enough where we want to dig into the compliance issues. And so that's another initiative that we're winding down. So I'm getting a new attorney for the marijuana initiative that's going to be hard dedicated to that task. And then I'm also getting In the state, we're getting 10 additional investigators. So the legislature was unanimous in the budget hearings about approving the BCP, the budget for the marijuana thing. So there, we shouldn't be letting up anywhere in our prioritization.
All right. Can I? My other, second only other question was cannabis related. Did you say 50,000 grow permits?
Yeah, this is crazy. So I go to these conferences and I speak, and there's, and it's, you know, the stakeholders are there, and the stakeholders are just like the stakeholders in anything, but they're marijuana cultivators. And I have these anecdotes. My grandfather grew marijuana on this land, you know? So you go to Humboldt County, and, you know, it's the same in Santa Cruz County, I swear. So I have these stakeholder outreach meetings. So I've been meeting, there's trade associations, the Emerald Growers Association in Trinity, Humboldt, and Mendocino County estimate that there are 50,000 farms that would be subject to our waiver or our order there in those three counties alone. And so if you look at it and we're still going to, we got to do Siskiyou County, Tehama County, Butte County, all these other counties, we have a lot of farms. Now, there are disincentives to enrollment because it's illegal under federal law. So, I mean, yesterday, part of the reason I wanted to hear your discussions, first of all, I'd love to hear the board work, but also I wanted to hear about this sort of fuzzy data approach to enrollment where you can't really identify where the water, where the contaminated wells are, because it's weird. We don't do that in any other program. We don't have programs where the discharger is anonymous. But in this cannabis situation, there might be a need to kind of further that. So it is incredible. So I've done two aerial tours in helicopters on certain watersheds. And small watersheds, tributaries to the Eel River, for example, and to the Sacramento River. And based on the aerial photography that we did on those tours, there are 10,000 grow sites in each of those watersheds. And that's just two little watersheds. 10,000 marijuana gardens.
You mentioned 50,000 growers that you will regulate and that you have added a full-time attorney to your staff. I hope he or she is a non-smoker. So
it's not a stakeholder, as far as I know.
You know, there's conflict of interest there.
How many do you estimate are in our region?
I'm starting to work with. Some substantial issues in this region. For better or worse, it was decided our project is a joint project with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, pun intended. And we are working with them. They have PYs also. Our enforcement project is confined to the North State regions for now. Now, I have resources at the Office of Enforcement that I will deploy here, and I've been in discussions with Supervisor McPherson already, and we'll be coordinating with the sheriff and county council here. So we're going to be doing some work here, but it won't be part of that initiative. Necessarily where we have staff people, boots on the ground staff people in the North State. Now, after we put some metrics in this year, hope we're going to ask for more people, because this is not a minor problem, and this is not a problem that's going to go away.
Thank you.
And I sit on the marijuana task force work group at the state board.
And the puns fly, and Ken is a master of it.
I bring brownies to every meeting.
See,
yeah.
So before Mr. Jordan has also a question, you know, there's two aspects, I think, to the growers. One of them is, you know, the discharge, because it becomes, you know, irrigated land. And by the way, you know, you think you have headaches, the Ag commissioners are scratching their head too, because they do have, you know, the DPR responsibilities. And so, you know, they're also wondering how to enforce the Ag commissioner's regulations of having a applicator's permit, et cetera.
They're an important part of our program.
Exactly.
It's DPR, Ag commissioners, county council. It's a really very challenging multi-agency effort.
But then separately from that, you know, they're irrigators, so, you know, where do they get the water from? And, you know, if it's surface water, how do they get the permits? So how does that get addressed within
So right now we're doing a lot of water rights enforcement on the North State because people are like driving up with trucks and just sucking water out of the river, right? And they have no water right, there's no place of use restrictions. And then people diverting in ways that exceed their right as riparians. Water rights is complicated, but we're taking enforcement actions now. The problem, frankly, from a structural standpoint, is the water rights enforcement laws are terrible. The penalties are low. Like we can barely fine a person enough for stealing a truckload of water to make it not worthwhile for that one truckload. So we're looking at trying to get criminal penalties for that type of activity and other things, but we really need the help of the legislature on that. Now, water quality is completely different, so if we have a combined impact, we're in really good shape, because it's $10,000 per day of violation. But water rights, it's like $500 a pop, and it's not even per day, it's just per incident. So it's really a difficult statutory scheme.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that slide you had that showed SEPs and ECAs, it's like a lot of stuff I see. I've never seen ECAs before. So I'm interested in hearing some more about those and whether my recollection is on SEPs, is that when you offer an SEP, it has to be something that's not of native benefit to the transgressor. It's of greater good, and it doesn't remedy something that the transgressor should have been doing already or as part of the enforcement action.
That's correct.
Okay, and then so the ECAs look like an alternative to that, to where, like you said, you can't compel, but it makes sense in the bigger picture, the better good to the community, to steer some of that money that way. So do you have to, if you're going to an ECA, do you also have to include an SEP to put somewhere else before you're able to do an ECA? So that's one question. And then I have a copy of the State Water Board's enforcement or whatever I have.
Policy, yeah.
And then the guidelines for SEPs, but I can't find anything for ECAs.
Is there compliance actions towards the end, maybe page 23 of the enforcement policy, so it is in there, and I think it's also listed in the index. So for enhanced compliance actions, a couple things. They're limited, as SEPs are, to 50% of the liability. They don't have to be combined with SEPs, and they're totally discretionary. So it really has to be, and in the situation I described, the credit from the ACL action, it was a combined matter, was $250,000. They also did a $500,000 SEP, but the project price was $5 million. So what we usually like to do with enhanced compliance action is we look at something that might be on the long-term CIP that we think should be a priority, but it's on the long-term capital improvement plan. And we say, you know what, if you bump this $5 million project to the front and get it done in 2 years, we will give you the $250,000 in seed money. So we use ECAs in that way. So it's a type of thing where it comes up and you think, yeah, that's a really good idea, we should do that. It does provide a benefit in some sense to the discharger, so we're very leery. It's not used as broadly, but it's a smart tool that can be used when it fits.
Sorry, so did you, Harvey?
I can give you a couple examples comments. If you're interested.
But go ahead. I'm trying to get this agenda wrapped up, but please go ahead.
So I don't know if I need examples, maybe another time, but I guess so my comment would be that it's the burden or the when we go through that process and you're building a case of you just recognizing that potential lies out there for an ECA in order to elevate something that would benefit us all, not necessarily the transgressor, and then just having the knowledge to bubble that to the top and say, hey, what about, right, kind of thing? Okay, yeah, no, I had never heard them before. I guess I'll read the back section of where I never got to in that policy.
I know it's hard to get past about page 15 of the enforcement policy.
All right, so I think this was very informative. I would like to thank you very much for coming yesterday and today. For me, I'm delighted to see that we made some good progress, and also definitely learn new things. I mean, similar to you, I blurred out, I think, that part because it was overload of information. And on that particular case, I was too focused on the electrical stuff. So my fault, I guess. But thank you very much. You know, we see we're in very good hands. And I appreciated also the effort you made in having that debrief conference call. So that was very helpful for me to, you know, check on the process. So I would like now to take a half hour lunch. And it's going to be, during our lunch, it'll be a closed session. It's going to be a personnel matter that will be discussed. So it strictly will be for the board. I would request from my fellow board members as promptly as possible to convey in the conference room. That way we can get through this item. And then lunch, I believe, is there, correct, Tammy?
Could we, just to make it even, say 1:30, that gives us 35 minutes?
Yes, 1:30, so thank you very much.